Welcome back to the realm of no external world. And happy spring in the realm of the other dependent character, where we, where things like seasons appear in the vast expanse of undifferentiated time and space. So today we can keep looking at these three characteristics of all phenomena, or three natures. But first I just thought it might be nice to follow up on something that Edie mentioned at one point about talking about this mind-only study of like, I think she said something like, I'm kind of waiting for the punchline. I'm like, I have a feeling it's coming. And so I was thinking, well, what is the punchline? And, you know, and in some ways I think, well, this upcoming paragraph about maybe particularly the sentence, maybe in some ways the central sentence in this chapter I feel is the sentence that says something like, in the absence of strong adherence of the other dependent character as being the imputational character, the thoroughly established character is known. We haven't gotten to this end yet, but in some ways I think that's the punchline. But it might not hit so hard when you hear that language. You might not be, wow! Because, you know, the language is pretty dense. An abbreviated version of that sentence, I mean, that's a particular sentence of the structure of the sutra, but it's pointing towards how we know suchness or emptiness. And and I think the Mahayana punchline in general is realization of emptiness and compassion combined. So we may have heard that kind of thing before, and we may have like been looking into emptiness a lot, and I feel like I have some kind of karmic affinity with wanting to study these emptiness teachings, so I tend to keep bringing this up. And I think that's because I kind of feel like it's kind of the punchline. But we haven't been talking so much about why that's so. So if you're not kind of an emptiness freak, you might not make that leap, that connection, just necessarily. So I haven't been talking about like why it's so important to realize the thoroughly established nature. So, you know, we could get, that could be a long discussion in and of itself, but maybe good to stop for a minute and look at this. Does anybody have any sense of why the teachings of what we sometimes call emptiness, but in this sutra they're calling suchness, or the thoroughly established character, which has to do with the way things aren't what we think they are, and that in this case, particularly mind-only teachings, that the world is not external to mind in the way we think and assume and experience it as. That what's the point of that?
Freedom.
Freedom. And why, and how is that freedom?
Nice.
It's nice.
It's nice.
Why is it nice?
I mean, it's freedom from suffering. I mean, it's one of the...
Because
it's like the traps, the hooks that hook us, it's like they dissolve.
That's a nice way to put it.
I'm thinking of my aunt, for example, who, you know, I got into this thing with yesterday. Mm-hmm. And when I perceive her as this solid thing and my mm-hmm. storyline and her storyline, which conflict as these solid things, there's a lot of suffering. And when there's some perception of the emptiness of all of that, or the mind projection on my behalf of all of that, it just dissolves. It's like the problem doesn't get resolved, the problem itself dissolves. Mm-hmm. And that's really nice.
Yeah.
Problem resolver.
Mm-hmm. Problem resolve. Like, she and I don't think we'll ever resolve any problems, but the problems may resolve.
Thank you. I think that's a great summary. Did Johnny want
to
add?
That is the point to me.
You want to add anything?
Only that I think what was described as something in chemistry is called a solution, which has several meanings. But it seems to me that emptiness, realization of emptiness might be like the realization of impermanence, and with co-arising interdependence, and that there's what this chapter suggests to me is there's two strong things we can do. We can adhere strongly, or we can abandon adhering strongly. In other words, relaxation. And it is the case that my fixed ideas, much as Janet has said, my fixed ideas and my ruminating on them have been the primary source of my suffering. And relaxing them and yielding to the emerging moment is a rather nice place to be. You don't have suffering. It might even be stubbing my toe, but at least there's no suffering in the pain. Yeah.
And Liz, did you want to say anything more about
it? Yeah, I kind of jumped in. I'm sorry. I got so excited.
No, it's very helpful. I was going to say something similar, but maybe not an eloquent yet, but just being able to let go of the story line. And I think for me, a help in not fixing on people as different in some way that I'm in opposition to. allowing more embracing and accepting and understanding and goodwill and willingness to work through things.
Yeah. And I think, like, we could say, yeah, all of Dharma practice comes down to something like this. And then in this unique Yogacara system, mind-only system, Sandhya Nirmochana Sutra presentation, the teaching of there's not really a world external to the mind, that not only, like, our basic ideas about people not, they're just like mental projections, but this seems to be taking this and maybe further step, maybe it's the same step, but just taking it further, of that actually what we experience as the world that exists apart from mind, apart from our experience of it, that it's the sutra seems to be saying that actually we can't prove that there's such a thing. We can't find such a world. And does that seem to be like extra to this issue of freedom? Maybe that seems like we don't need to go that far. Does anybody feel like see the value in going that far?
It seems like mostly we tend to argue about that part of it. You know, like up until there, I'm like, yeah, I'm with you, right on, right on. And then the minute you say that, my, you know, oh, come on.
Or even if we don't...
No, I'm not convinced that for my experience of my, maybe it's a puny experience of liberation, but I'm not convinced that totally believing that there is no external world other than the one that I'm generating, it's almost like, I hate to say it, this may really sound blasphemous to you, but it's almost like I don't really care about that. I mean, show me how that would actually, you know, totally, but letting go to grasping, liberation, you know, I'm there. But I'm not sure, it seems like this extra point that you just kind of get caught in having these theoretical discussions about, and
So I just want to edit this your sentence a little bit when you said something like believing in the fact that there's not this objective world outside our experience. I would say it's more about not believing that there is one. It's not so much we're trying to create a belief that there's no external world, because a belief is an imputational character. It's more like we're loosening our belief that we seem to hold, whether we think so or not, that there actually is a world outside. So this is a slight edit of the way you would maybe say that, but I think it's important to say that we're not trying to create any new beliefs with any emptiness teachings.
It's trying to prove.
Or it's more like we're eliminating beliefs that we have, faulty beliefs that we have, rather than creating better ones.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like a slight edit, but actually it turns the whole thing upside down. Linguistically, it's a slight edit, but it really turns it upside down.
Yeah.
I've been thinking this the past week that there's two parts of a person. There's the form part and the formless part. The form part is the body, and the formless part is the mind. But the mind has consciousness, but the body doesn't have consciousness. So when you die, when consciousness separates from the body, then in my case, Daryl would be dead. But I would continue as an accumulation of impressions in the mind. The mind that would continue. And so in this way, because these impressions are there and they come into consciousness because they're already in consciousness, then when we take on a new body, it forms according to consciousness. If I become fearful in an intermediate state, then I might be shrunken into it. But if I stand up and remember the teachings, then I might experience good fortune, because that's where the consciousness is moving to. And so the world again is created.
By consciousness, the world is created. And I think we have to be careful too, though, about this this story that who I really am is the consciousness that's continuously traveling on from life to life. There's this early teaching in the Pali Canon where there's this monk comes and says this. As I understand it, it's the body dies, but consciousness is reborn. And which we often hear that in something very similar to that anyway, in Buddhist teachings, especially in Tibetan-oriented teachings. But interestingly, in this early sutra, the other monks say to this one monk, actually, the Buddha doesn't teach it quite like that, and they kind of argue back and forth, and then they go to the Buddha, and the Buddha says, no, actually, I don't say that there's a consciousness that goes on from life to life. I just say something like, when this arises, that arises, and basically, he goes into the standard explanation of dependent co-arising. So it's although it's very close. It seems like if we say that that who I really am is this consciousness, then we've kind of...
It would be it's imagination to identify myself as the consciousness, mm-hmm. but because it has...
It makes a self out of it.
There's me traveling in between lifetimes.
Yeah. I think that's what we naturally do.
Okay, so, like, my mind is my life. But when my body dies, but... In reality, my life continues because my mind continues and takes another form. And like, what sometimes can view the mind as being like a point of light or something, can think of this as the self. This is my central self.
There's
other ways to see, to form consciousness as a self. You could also see it as a plurality of segments of dharmas or phenomena. Traveling like in a cluster, or you could also see it like in a single being moving as it continues.
I think when we make it anything continuous and unceasing, then it starts to look more like what we call a self. So I think to say like a stream of consciousness that's actually, you know, quote unquote stream, like. Conventionally speaking, a stream, but it's actually arising and ceasing every moment. There's nothing permanent there. It's just conditionality. There's a cessation of consciousness, and then that becomes a condition for a new. Yeah, there's a moment, but a moment's only a moment.
But the response is continual.
Yeah, but I think we have to just be, I think it's okay to talk that way. We just have to be really careful that we don't make the continuum into something like a permanent self.
Yeah, I've already.
Which is very easy for us to do because that's the way we often think, so.
Yeah, I'm just.
Yeah. Yes, Liz.
Like Kathy, I think when we get to this point of considering that there is no other, there is not a world apart from mine, then I feel like, actually, I don't know what mind is. You know, and isn't mind kind of beyond definition? Or is, anyway, all of a sudden I'm upside down now.
One way of talking about mind, interestingly, I think when we say three characteristics of all phenomena or three natures of all phenomena, it also works to say there's three characteristics of mind or three natures of mind. So if we want to, like, in this, according to this chapter now, we could say, well, what is mind? Mind has these three characteristics, and we'll review this soon. And this is a nice explanation, somewhat, you know, elaborate, but mind is not so simple in a way. So mind has this, you know, appearing quality of consciousness, and it has this grasping quality of objectifying things as real and external, and it has this empty quality. Mind does. So it has all of that. But also, going back to your original question of is there anything apart from mind? What if we say, like, instead of saying mind, say experience? And going back to Kathy's point too, say, do I think that there's some world other than my experience? And it's almost like whether I do or not, it's like there's no way to know, right? But maybe another question would be, do we see the problems, the potential suffering, when we believe that there's a world, which includes like beings and all kinds of things that are in a world, that exists inherently, and I think that's what exists means in this case. If it were to exist apart from mind, it inherently exists on its own. It doesn't depend on my mind. Now we might say, outside the mind-only system, I'm not saying it exists inherently, I'm saying it dependently arises, but not dependent on mind. So then we might be able to say that and still say, therefore, it's an ungraspable world, ungraspable, dependently arising world, therefore it's empty, but it still exists outside my experience. Maybe that the middle way view of Nagarjuna might be somewhat like that, actually. But can we see some function of actually, some helpful liberating function of saying, we're just not going to substantialize any reality outside our experience?
Yeah, you used philosophical words a few weeks ago, and you said this is an epistemology, not an ontology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When I hear the phrase mind only, what I'm hearing is we're only going to be concerned with experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to get into metaphysical questions,
mm-hmm.
nor are we going to get into the ontic status of physical questions.
Yep.
We're basically going to be satisfied in our practice with finding in our consciousness the path. And to that extent, we only need to use mind. We don't have to be assured of anything else.
Yeah.
And this is the way it happens. This is the way mind manifests in three ways, etc., etc. So it gets down to practice, I think. It gets down to what this chapter talks about. When we're strictly adhering, this is what happens. And when we're abandoning, this is what happens. This is two things we can do with mind.
Mm-hmm.
With mind only, we can strictly adhere and suffer, or we can abandon and not suffer. I mean, so it's not saying that we're making everything up. It's just saying that our experience is thus. And how we choose to use our consciousness makes a difference.
And if we posit anything outside our experience, we tend to run into trouble.
We can run into trouble.
And which we do. So in a way, to say, like, yeah, it's not a matter of about the ontological status of the world outside experience. I think it starts sounding like that sometimes. Let's prove whether there's a world or not outside. It's not getting so much into that. It's just saying that if we posit a world that is substantially independent of mind, that it's a different entity than mind. In other words, mind and phenomena are not one entity. They're dualistic. These are all ways of talking about the same point, that we start to have a problem.
So I hear Kathy saying, it doesn't matter, who cares? I hear violent agreement. Because ultimately we're just saying, it doesn't matter if there is a world outside, or we don't need to talk about that. It's like, I'm in violent agreement with you. And I think ultimately this school does say, don't sweat it.
But it's saying, if we believe that there is an external world that exists inherently apart from mind, we'll suffer. So it's not saying, let's try to prove that there's not exactly, or let's believe that there's not. Kathy wants to...
Well, I just want to represent my view.
Yeah, please.
Because the who cares part isn't really, that's sort of more the superficial part. And this truly, and I don't have a problem with having this view. I don't see it's incompatible. I definitely think it's valuable to study the ways we get ourselves in trouble by the ways that we mm-hmm. our sense onto the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's really, really helpful. But the part about it that I still am just not, I'm not totally behind it.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a certain aspect, it's more like I'm coming from I do believe there's a world outside of human. And I can never prove it, because all I can ever look is from my human experience, and I'll acknowledge that. But and maybe it's just a belief, and so I'll be happy with my belief. But I love that there's a whole bunch of this planet that's not human. And I think that one of our troubles is that we try to make everything human. And to the extent that this, and I don't necessarily think this is that, but I think when it gets taken to its extreme of, now you really, really, really have to believe this kind of thing, I go, but I don't. You know, because I do think there's, even though I know the stars are like really not there, they are there.
Well, there's three ways in which stars have three natures.
Like, even if they're not, I'm not really seeing it, that the light was like a really long time ago, and I'm really, you know, it's there. It's like shamanic to me. It's shamanic. It's there. It's something.
What do you mean by it's there?
Well,
I mean, it has an other dependent character, which means that stars really do appear. We don't deny that they appear.
Yeah.
But really there, when we're using the language of this, usually really there means inherently exists.
And that's the part where I don't care. It's like, however it is that anybody needs to define that they're there, they're not there, I'm just going to stand there and be with the star and go, wow. That, you know, that's what makes sense to me.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and that's the part where I don't really care. It's okay if it's, however a person wants to explain
it. It's there, but how about, let's say... if you're relating to the star, like you're just with it like that, what about, say, let's take your own body.
Uh-huh.
If you relate to that in the same way as the star.
Uh-huh.
Like, I'm just here with my body like this, but now suddenly I have, my limbs all have to be amputated or something. Now suddenly it's like, but it really is here, and like, now we're going to have a big problem, right? When we have a big problem.
I discovered that when I got there. I can't tell you what it would be like.
This is like pre-training before it happens.
Because
it's coming.
People who get amputated have all sorts of experiences about what their body is.
Yeah, but they probably aren't that happy about it.
I don't know.
At when at first they discover. or, you know, death, you could say. This is like, this is a way to prepare for death, you could say, this whole teaching. It's like, so if we could really realize these three, how these three natures work fully, I trust that that at the time of death, we wouldn't resist. We also wouldn't try to speed it up or slow it down or try to die or try to live. It's like there'd be complete freedom and peace. And so with the star, you know, I think with anything, is, and this doesn't apply just to mind only, I think some of these discussions we could apply also to any system of emptiness, like the middle way system, where it's like things really don't inherently exist. And it's not like we're trying to believe that they don't. It's more like the premise is we do believe that they do, whether we philosophically we think they do or not. It's like we act and live as if things really do exist, and we suffer because of that. So it's more like we're not trying to exchange our belief with another one. We're more like deeply questioning our beliefs, and we don't have to say, well, okay, now I see there really is no external world. But more like, I can no longer believe that there is. See how that's a little bit different? Rich.
I think whether this real world exists separately from us or not, I agree. I've come to the conclusion that you were saying that we're really trying to suspend our belief that it has to be there in order for us to function. Say that there has to be a separate phenomenal world separate from our minds. And if we do believe that, it can cause problems, because then all of us as individuals can argue about that world out there is. But once we understand that from our own experience, it can only be what we experience, and that they're all different because we're different perspectives and cultural filters through which we experience this imaginary world, then we're not holding on to it as tightly, and it takes away the need to argue about that world. But that doesn't mean we can just do whatever we want, because that world doesn't really exist, because we're not saying we're trying to believe it doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're all dependently arising along with this imaginary world that we all share in our experiences. So this imaginary world really exists, but not inherently and not permanently, but as a dependently co-arising thing of which we're a part.
Yeah, well, that's here.
Mm-hmm. That's realistic.
The external world has an other dependent character. And then when we start to look at this other dependent world, I think it's good to remember as we go over these definitions again that it's very easy to think of, then we kind of reify this idea of dependent co-arising, I think, very easily. I know I do this of like, yeah, it's like, well, there really is an other dependent world. But that's why when they talk about its mere appearance, I think really is really helpful to me, that it's dependently arisen mere appearance. And that's why when you like a mirage, they have all these classical examples, like a mirage or a reflection of the moon and water, these things that like, it really appears as water, and yet if we try to grasp a mirage, it's not there. And that's what the other dependent, that's what dependent co-arising world is. We think there are these dependently co-arisen things, and it's just they're really here, and yet they depend on other things. I think we blend inherent existence with dependent co-arising, and you know, isn't that interesting? Because our belief in inherent existence is so strong, even if we have a nice philosophical system that says, yeah, this is a dependently co-arisen floor. I think of like the versions like Thich Nhat Hanh sometimes uses of like, you know, we can see the woodcutter and the bamboo in the floor, and these are the conditions that it depends on. And yet, that does nothing to eradicate the sense that like, it's really here. It's nicely dependent on these things, but it's kind of like, really, we're still believing it. It exists in and of itself. It just, in a way, it's approaching it. It's saying, it does We know it depends on these things, and yet, in the moment, it appears to be substantially existing, or in this system of mind only, it appears to be independent of mind. If we took our mind out of the room, that we imagine with a mind that there would be this floor in here.
Well, if we call it the imaginary world, then we're not saying that it's really there, because then we can talk about it as just the shared image we have of this floor as something that's mind only, say, but all our separate minds that aren't separate, that are dependently co-arising also, just this big flux of stuff, a sharing, in order for this to work, is sharing this imaginary world.
Yeah.
Not exactly the same.
Not exactly the same, but very similar.
So that we can interact safely and with compassion.
We can...
Without that, where is compassion?
Yeah.
Without understanding that something is going to suffer here besides me,
mm-hmm.
if I don't hold compassion for all this.
Yeah. And the compassion point is important to keep remembering too. And there's so many different angles at one point that maybe we won't do today, but because this often comes up, I made a list of like 8 different angles on the compatibility of mind only and compassion, and how, you know, kind of different ways of looking at how those two go together and how actually they can't not go together. But one way that comes up is, as you're talking about that, is we share, due to our karmic dispositions, very similar ways of viewing a floor, especially like as Americans in modern society. We have even more similar karmic dispositions to seeing this as a floor compared to like African rainforest tribe that would not experience it this way we are. But not that they wouldn't see anything, but there's not a floor independently existing from mind. You can see between these two groups of different kinds of people even. But in terms of the suffering and compassion part, the more we see how we, when we grasp an inherently existent world independent of mind, and how we, that grasping is the definition of suffering, the more we see how all sentient beings are doing this, and that is their suffering, the more the compassion can arise, like, wow, even if we're these dream beings, look at how we're experiencing suffering in this dream through this very way. The more I see how my suffering is all coming from grasping inherent existence that doesn't exist, the more I see how, when I see others suffering, I can more and more quickly make the connection. Oh, I see that they're doing the exact same thing as me. Or at least I can strongly infer that. And therefore, I can maybe then skillful means comes in, and I can see how, because this is how I'm working on compassion for myself and my suffering through these teachings, the more I can be with these other suffering beings, compassionately working with them. And again, we get into this thing, this doesn't mean go like, just tell people, just see everything is not external to mind. Not like that. But yet, seeing that actually is everyone's suffering, one condition, one key condition amongst many for everyone's suffering. And therefore, the way that we can be with them in this dream world is, I think, different. We can, it's more, our openness can be more complete. I think it gets a little hard to talk about here. Yeah.
Something I've been kind of wanting to say, and I'm not sure I'll articulate it clearly, but I'm going to try that, you know, this question of, you know, what's the usefulness of considering dropping the belief in the next world. And there's something to me about, most of us can kind of grasp, yes, there's a certain kind of suffering that I get, like with my aunt.
Yes, yeah.
And so there's a certain level of conventional or relative freedom from that kind of suffering that happens.
From holding a story to be true.
Exactly. Yeah. But there's something further to me. Mm. It's like if we think about freedom as degrees of freedom,
yeah.
it's like there's the freedom of the immediate, of the obvious suffering. Mm. I have cancer and therefore I suffer, or I miscarried and therefore I suffer, or my aunt is acting this way and therefore I'm suffering. But to me, there's some incredible value in the consideration of dropping the entire external world, because it opens up the possibility for true delight, for the pure land, for something that's even beyond what we can even conceive of lack of suffering, like a level of freedom and bliss that is spoken about in Pure Land or in the Buddha fields or in the iconography of the Dakinis dancing amidst the wrath and the bliss and the joy, and it's all this, you know, this incredible arising of bliss, which includes incredible wrath and fire, but it's experienced from a completely different level of perspective. So for me, there's some value, and the thing that I love about the Dharma is it's not just, here's how not to suffer from stubbing your toe. It's like this radical promise, or this radical invitation to experience the stars in a way that is even beyond what any of us in this room can possibly comprehend as bliss.
And thank you, that's beautiful, yeah.
It's like beyond just that level, it's like there's levels. And so sometimes I just find it so unfathomable that the recognition of emptiness is the first bhumi. It's like, what the hell's the eighth? You know, like if you can get to the first and not be grouchy about your aunt, that's such a radical freedom. What would the eighth bhumi be like? And I personally like to imagine that there are beings and human beings who've realized this in the past 2,000 years, and that we have this unbelievable good karma to have encountered these teachings and to have the kind of mind that is interested in them. To me, that's the words of my perfect teacher, and you know, all the teachings on how precious this human birth is to have encountered this is to me just incredible. So I don't know if I articulate that clearly, but there's something beyond just the, if we drop these storylines and we suffer less, and if we drop them completely, who knows what will happen?
Yeah, an infinite possibility. Mm-hmm. It's that how far we're going
how
to take
far
it.
How far will it go?
Yeah, and I think it's that was well put too about how it's the same. The same teaching can apply to like, oh yeah, maybe my aunt's not quite the way I think she is. The same teaching, you know, which is up here, right, can be just applied more and more. If you say it's just not believing our stories to be true, I think that's another way we could say this. It's just, okay, we're not believing the stories about our aunt, but now we have a story. The proposal is we have a story that things inherently exist, or that there's a world external to mind. And so we say, that's not really a story, that's fact. But actually, this would say, that's called imputational characters. We could say the story character. We have that story, very strongly believed story. And so what if we didn't really believe that story?
And it just keeps going and going.
And yeah, and then the story about that. And then, you know, Dogen's going beyond Buddha, you know. Then and again, like, I think this is a key thing about this, yeah, not creating another story of emptiness. Mm-hmm. Like Nagarjuna says, those who grasp the view of emptiness are incurable. You know, it's like, because how are you going to help them? It's like, it's much better to grasp, like, totally solid existence, because then we have something to work with. We can keep refuting these beliefs without creating new ones. But if you keep refuting them and then you say, you come to the conclusion, oh, so it's all empty, the thoroughly established, no external world, I believe that. And people say, like, well, wait, aren't you grasping something? No, this is not grasping. It really is. And then, uh-oh. Because it's all about, this is a whole big conceptual model that I think is very helpful to fully engage the conceptual model, but that it destroys itself in the end. It has to.
And then what's there?
What's there? What is there?
I want to go back to some of those answers. Mine is short, not long-winded.
You have a short? Okay, go ahead.
Okay. I had read in a book what I think was a reputable source that mind is like, I've kind of put this together what I think it's a good assumption. Mind,
with my proposition. I want to find out what you think about this, because you, I have a lot, of, in those things, a lot of difficulty in communicating, and I'm not creating this. Okay, and I put forth the notion that the person was composed of two parts. One was the form, and one was the formless. The formless is the mind, and the form is the body. And I read from a credible source that the body has no consciousness, that the mind has the consciousness. What do you think of that?
I would not say that, well, it depends what you mean by formless.
I mean the mind. We talk about that a lot.
I mean, it's not, if we're talking about like the form skanda.
The mind has no form. Exactly.
Has no form, physical form. You mean physical form? Has no physical form. I agree with that.
Does the mind have a form?
Not physical form.
Does it have an other than physical form?
Well, it has an appearance.
What is the form that the mind appears as?
This room, in terms of mind-only school, this room is mind. It's a manifestation of mind.
This room has consciousness.
It's a manifestation of mind.
So this room but, has consciousness, because it is body, which this authority
it's
of consciousness, but it says mind, but the consciousness has mind has consciousness.
So what's
when the body dies, consciousness removes itself from the body, and the body is simply dead. But then consciousness apparently is, to use simple language, is reincarnated.
So what's
it takes on another body.
So what's the question?
What do you think of that proposition?
That there's the form and the formless
aspects of the person.
If we talk about physical form, I'll go with that.
The form being the body, mm-hmm. The formless being the mind.
Yeah.
But the most significant difference is that mind has consciousness and body doesn't. What do you think of that?
That mind has
because
consciousness.
Because I think this is important in understanding mind only. I really That's why I've been thinking about it. Not because
mind, well, it's almost like mind is consciousness in a way, right? You say mind has consciousness?
Whereas body doesn't. Mm-hmm. Yes, and in that respect, I use the term, but not
form.
But
okay.
Let's split this body. This is fundamental stuff.
But you are.
I am not.
So is there.
Authority, I think, that I want to hear.
So, okay, so body has no consciousness, and mind does. So then.
I'm sorry, I was speaking, I didn't hear what you were saying.
You said body has no consciousness, but mind does. Okay.
Body has no consciousness, but mind has.
Okay.
It can be the same.
So then is there another step beyond, or is there...
What do you think of what I said?
I'll agree with that. Tentatively, I'll go with that.
The body has no consciousness, and that there is consciousness with mind.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, because...
Yeah, we can go with that.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for your
answer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'd like to return to those and this course in this way, is that I think what's being said in this chapter in particular is all phenomena have three characteristics. Now, two of them, the first two, we can agree or disagree, but we communicate about something that we all experience similarly, and we can argue about our terms, we can argue about our meanings, but we're arguing about the same thing. And that same thing is ineffable and is then thoroughly established. So all I think this is saying is that anytime you discuss, is keep in mind all three of these manifestations. And at some point you can all say, well, even if we agree to disagree, maybe together in that silence, we are manifesting that they're established in this whole thing.
Oh, he's all three. Yeah.
All three.
Mm-hmm.
But I think quite often in discussions like we've had, or I wouldn't want to be a part of Muammar Gaddafi's Pure Land or Pol Pot's Pure Land. But I'm sure he imagines something where that's a very nice thing to go and you can see what's happening there. So I don't go for this business of exercising the imagination to the point of hallucination in some way because it feels good. Nor do I go to this idea of positing or what's the difference between body and mind. That, to me, gets very frustrating. But I can come back and say, well, we are all discussing something that we can, even our disagreement about, convey something that's there that's similar, that's thoroughly established, even though we cannot define that for its meaning. So just resting in that, it gives a place for everybody to exist. And I think only through that third column can we speak credibly of compassion. I think that's where it has to come up. This idea like we're all just approximating what it is that's thoroughly established. And none of us are right.
Anything we can ever think or say about it is not it.
It's not it.
By definition.
But we can enjoy the fact that we're both agreeing and disagreeing about it, whatever it is. And there's a place in there that you can get comfort, even in the disagreement. That here we are disagreeing about it. So I think what this is saying to me is becoming clearer and clearer is let's keep in mind that all phenomena, anything that we can speak of, even seeing ourselves speaking, has these three characteristics.
Mm-hmm.
But let's not forget the thoroughly established while we're arguing about terms and meanings.
Yeah. Yeah, let's not, even if we haven't realized it, let's not forget this possibility that there's a completely ungrasped suchness that's pervading everything all the time.
It's pervading everything all the time. Mm-hmm. That is the primary stuff of our liberty.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know if we got any closer to a punchline here. We had some discussion, you know. But yeah, that's just like kind of context, which we could have a whole class on just the context of what's the point of emptiness teachings or suchness, you know. And so let's keep remembering that and bring forth questions if it seems like we're getting lost in the trees and forgetting the forest kind of thing. But now, let's go back into the trees for a little bit because I think the more we get into the system, the more the vision becomes clearer, I think.
One more question. In this thing, also, the sensory consciousness.
Yeah. Which, in a way, are connected with the body, right? Are kind of connected to the body. Like, there's an.
In this book, which was, I think that's talking about 51 middle factors of cool. But it calls them like little minds, lesser minds with consciousnesses.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder how they can actually be a part of the form and have this kind of consciousness. Where does that consciousness come?
Like an eye consciousness.
Yeah, but that's not like the stream of consciousness or whatever is our accumulation of consciousness.
No, it's right. They say if we're talking about this rebirth thing, that there's these six consciousnesses, one with each sense field, but it's the mental, the six mental consciousness in some systems, like
just the physical consciousness, the five sensory.
Yeah, though at death those ones stop.
Okay, but what about the consciousness of them that exists during life? How can this be referred to as a consciousness when it's distinct from the larger consciousness? The one that has its...
Which one?
Its root or whatever in the Avaya Vijnana consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Well, so there's different systems. So in this mind-only system, because this is what we're talking about, there's Avaya consciousness actually has the seeds for all the other six.
And
one of them is the body. Actually, the body is born from Avaya consciousness. Okay. So in this system, it all keeps coming back to mind. And actually what's reborn in this system, because I think most other Buddhist systems don't posit Avaya Vijnana, the eighth consciousness. So they say that there's a subtle continuum of the six mental consciousness that's so-called reborn. It's not a continuous stream, but a continuum of cause and effect in terms of the sixth consciousness, and that would be born in the next life. This system says there's that same continuum of cause and effect, but now we're calling it the eighth storehouse consciousness. That's what's reborn, because that can carry karmic dispositions. It can store these seeds for karmic dispositions from this life.
Why would you not reborn, or is it just like a stream coming out of
it? Yeah, exactly. If we say it's the Alaya, I mean, how do we... we're talking about something very abstract.
What
was followed, right?
In the stream is what was came before the previous one.
Yeah, it's Alaya Vijnana is a stream. In fact, the sutra says it's flowing like a river.
And the previous moment would initiate from the last moment of consciousness in the previous life.
Yeah.
This is what would...
Uh-huh. All the systems would agree with that, yeah.
And everything would follow.
Yeah. So, here, the Alaya Vijnana creates the other dependent character. The other-powered, dependent arising, it's the basis of the imputation. It means it's like what the imputation is imputed onto. It's a basis, or like the ground of imputation, is the other-dependent world. We could call it the signs of phenomena. Maybe let's not get into that. That'll be get too technical. Skip that part for now. We could call this the mere appearance of the world, and it's often Asanga, the founder of the mind only school, defines this other dependent character as the six sense organs, the six sense consciousnesses, and the six sense objects. Everything's included there. Everything fits into one of these, because the objects would include like the room and the cushions and all these. Those are all these mental objects, but also all the sensory objects and all the consciousnesses, you know, all these 18 elements from the earlier chart, right? There's all these 18 things. That's called the other dependent character of all phenomena. We can also say of all minds. Mind has an other dependent character, which means it appears, mind can appear as like an I consciousness and an I organ even. And it can mind can appear as color, because as we saw earlier, that all the objects are all just mental projections actually. So we also, when we talk about mind only, citta matra, or mere concept like vijñāti matra, that's associated with, really kind of equal to, this other dependent character. When we say, well, what is, you know, everything is mind, right? That's the other dependent. So the point is, we could say to realize mind only is not actually the full extent of this project. Really, it's about realizing the thoroughly established. It's connected, because if we realize everything is mind, that means that we can't find an imputational character, which means if we can't find an imputational character, we have the thoroughly established character. But so the realization of mind only, or the realization that all is mere concept, which like Vasubandhu and others talk about, in a way is slightly different than the realization of the thoroughly established character or emptiness in the mind only school. They're very similar. You have to realize, we could say first we realize that everything is only mind, and that implies this other step of realizing that we can't find anything substantially existing apart from mind, and that not finding anything substantially existing apart from mind is the realization of thoroughly established. These are a lot of words.
My reading of the chapter does not suggest that we have a direct grasping of the thoroughly established. We realize thoroughly established, if I'm reading this right, by loosening our strict adherence to imputational other dependent.
Mm-hmm.
And in the abandoning of strict adherence to those things, we realize
yes.
Thoroughly established.
Yep.
It's a subtraction thing. Not an addition.
Yeah. As with all emptiness meditations,
right.
Realization of emptiness is not like getting a grasp on something. Emptiness is a nice word, and some people like to translate it as spaciousness or fullness or things like this. I think they have their advantages saying that, but I think it's these negative words like voidness and emptiness have stuck, and for a good reason. I think it's very valuable to say that when you realize emptiness, you're realizing an absence of something. It's not something to get a hold of. You're just realizing that something can't be found. And the thoroughly established is doing this strange thing, because it actually is about emptiness, but it's calling it the thoroughly established character, which is doesn't sound so much like an absence, right? It doesn't sound so much like you can't find something. It sounds like it's what's truly found. So this sutra is really playing with this thing. Emptiness teachings were around before the sutra. But as I said before, the Tibetan term, which I don't know what it is literally translated as thoroughly established, but the Sanskrit original is translated more as like the perfect or complete or consummate nature, which doesn't have that same quality of thoroughly established. But the sutra talks about, you know, it says, we haven't gotten to this part yet, but you know, the other dependent is not thoroughly established as being the imputational. So it uses that word in terms of it's not thoroughly established, and then so it's kind of making that leap and saying, this is not thoroughly established as that. Therefore, we call this the thoroughly established. You know, we could even say it's thoroughly established as being not this in this. So in that way, it's, you know, it's not substantializing something. It's just saying it's thoroughly established that you can't find anything, that you can't find this in this. Anyway, so to keep going with other dependent, you know, it's known, we haven't gotten to this paragraph, but it's known in dependence upon strongly adhering to the other dependent as being the imputational, which is a really interesting line. When you first read how this thing works, before you get up to there, you think, well, the way you would know the other dependent, wouldn't you think it would be just like just relaxing and just letting everything be the way it is? And then that would be knowing this inconceivable other dependent. But actually, it's known in dependence on grasping, adhering to it as being the imputational.
I totally don't get that.
It's and what it has to do with is it's about known. You could say it's playing with this word known. In order to know this unknowable, inconceivable thing, you have to grasp it.
It's a little like what you said earlier, grasping emptiness.
Yeah.
Here you're grasping another dependent nature.
Yeah. Yeah. It's in order to know it, in order to know this inconceivable flux of impermanent flow of energy soup. In order to like know it means to like get a hold of it. I think you could say to know it dualistically, but that's what knowing means actually.
So
to know it as something.
It still relies upon all of these arbitrary terms. We get the first two of them. We cannot see interdependence apart from putative objects that are depending on each other.
We can't see it or know it except by strongly adhering to it as being our ideas of it, the imputational.
Right.
Which is a little bit like this thing I was mentioning, like we have the floor and then we see how it's dependent on the bamboo and the wood maker and stuff. And therefore, in a way, you could say we're starting to know something about the other dependent, but we're just grasping all these ideas about it, actually. It's not really directly like, you know, realizing the other dependent or something like that. And I brought up, I think, in the last Dharma talk, this is not in the sutra, but my teacher teaches it, says this is his idea, something like this thing about beauty. When we actually like kind of directly realize beauty in a way where before we even put any words on it, when you're just like impacted by the sunset, you know, or something like that, that's in a way you could say almost like a direct realization of the other dependent. The sutra doesn't talk about, the sutra is more concerned about direct realization of this thoroughly established. So it kind of saying, this is kind of distorted. It talks about it as being afflicted character, this other dependent. But you could say, if we were to directly experience the dependent, the mystery of other dependents, I'd say this is like Dogen saying, when the myriad things come forth and make us, the way that we're actually arising, every moment dependent on everything else, if we just kind of like open to that for a second, that's like the beauty of the world. This is not beautiful, actually. It's thoroughly established. It's like emptiness. It's beyond beauty and non-beauty. But this, because it's appearance, it's the apparent world. If we could glimpse for a second the appearance of this ungraspable world, it's like that's a moment of experience of beauty. This is a little like, you know, creative riff on the sutra that's not in there. Or awe, yeah. Did you say awe? Mm-hmm. Yeah, awe, right. We're in awe. Like this is like almost beyond awe. Mm-hmm. If we start feeling awe about emptiness, we're probably like we're slipping back into other dependent.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's beyond awe?
What's beyond awe? Suchness. And with all these things, I think as I mentioned last time, I think to get used to the system, it's really helpful to like start taking things, like you could take objects or experiences, and throughout, this is a nice homework assignment, just apply these, you know, the three, every experience has these three characteristics, so just like look at experiences in terms of these three, even just as a conceptual model, and it starts to be open up how to relate to this stuff. Does that make sense? So like, you could say your story about your aunt. I'm having this argument with an aunt and I'm starting to feel tension around it and stuff. And so there's three characteristics of this situation. You kind of have to limit it to like a specific, are we going to say the tension in my stomach about the situation or my aunt? You could limit it to one piece, the narrower we can get. Yeah, the three natures of your aunt. She has this merely appearing aspect of like a person, and that's your aunt, not just any person. And she appears that way, and that's the way that she's created by all things, including you. In this, so she's actually, it's ungraspable. And if you start looking at the dependent co-arising of your aunt, you can't find your aunt already in that. But she does appear to be this particular person. When you see her, you immediately say, that's my aunt. But that's because of all these conditions that you created, and you could say that others created too, but the mindfulness school is mainly concerned with that you created your aunt. And
she came into existence in her life because of past life connections.
Well, there's
so
that
there's
part
long,
too.
Long time
you could say that's part of her dependent co-arising.
And the relationship that she has is also mind-created because she sees her aunt as being of a particular nature.
Yeah, so yeah. And so she's particularly focusing on that part, how she's creating her aunt.
Yeah, so it's a co-created relationship.
Yeah, and we can't grasp it. It's inconceivable. And so you could say that's the part. And then, and you can know the other dependent character of your aunt by strongly adhering to that vision of her as kind of like, you could almost say about this that it's like to create a conceptual idea of the other dependent is the way we know the other dependent. The way I'm talking about it right now is grasping this as the story that I'm telling about it. Does that make sense?
Knowing this method, we can begin to recreate them also, right?
Yeah, we can imagine them.
And then we can also put it in our stream, even when we're not there, like lie. And prayers for them.
We can do all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Well, but we haven't described this. We can
do
all kinds of things, but we haven't done this yet.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what I'm saying right now.
Mm-hmm.
We can recreate our experience.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not recreate.
And then we have the imputational. Completely imagined, mere fantasy, the conceptually grasped, the projected. that and the sutra definition, this is a nice piece to really get familiar with these, this complicated way of putting it, but it's a really nice, concise way. It's that which is imputed or posited or imagined in terms of names and symbols, so we use names, imputed to the other dependent. It's not just randomly saying, like, let's call that your aunt. It's like we're putting words particularly on this other dependent, unique other dependent experience of your aunt. It's not just like random. We're imputing it to a particular other dependent phenomena. And we're imagining it as the own being, svabhava, the own being or the essence or the attributes, like my aunt is old or something. You know, any adjective to describe her that we also attribute an essence to, of phenomena in order to designate any convention whatsoever, convention of an aunt.
But saying my aunt is old when she's in the room, when I'm looking at her, is different than saying my aunt is old when she's not in the room. Because then I'm experiencing a fixed idea in my memory, and it's not my aunt at all.
Yeah, and also when you see your aunt in a group of people that are all older than her, you say, "Wow, my aunt's the youngest in the room."
Right.
So
in this sense, I'm totally creating my aunt, even my objections to her, or my love.
Yeah, any experience you have of her is your experience.
My experience and my memory.
And it's not, again, it's not totally random. Like, we don't just call the light bulb your aunt. But, But we can't know this basis except for this.
And let's look at the third.
Yeah, and let's, and this also, this is known in dependence. The way we know this one is known in dependence upon names connected with signs.
That's pretty clear.
We know it when we say the name aunt connected with, so these signs, this links back up to the signs of phenomena, which are like the ways, the aspects of your aunt, like, your aunt has a particular blue eyes or something, or it's one of the signs of your aunt, and when you put the name aunt connected with those particular signs, dependently arisen signs, then you know this one. So then this one, the completely perfect, the perfectly real, consummate, it's, according to the sutra, suchness or thusness, and it's an emptiness. It's an emptiness of the imputational in the other dependent. I think that's a really nice definition. It's also the emptiness of subject-object duality. And it's known, this one's known in dependence upon strongly adhering to this as being this. This is known in dependence upon the absence of strong adherence to this as being this. So it's just that very, you know, you can know it or realize it. And now I think, in a way, you could say the known. Well, let's just say these are all dualistic knowing. I think to even just do it, even conceptually or dualistically, or say they're all conceptual knowing, let's call it that. To even conceptually understand this one, you can conceptually understand it if you don't strongly adhere to your ideas or words as being this, you know, calling the energy soup.
The word that's used in here is abandonment. Is that what they mean by, what you mean there by absence of?
It does. I think that's... Well,
they completely abandon the...
Oh, that's later, yeah. If you look before that, it says, it's known in dependence. The paragraph just before, I think, is like known in dependence upon absence. Yeah, then it gets into this thing about the afflicted and the purified character. But let's actually, before we go there... Look, these analogies, these classic metaphor analogies are really helpful, I think, that actually, so this sutra does this. We'll read it afterwards. So let's say there's a crystal, a very clear crystal, which these were the days before glass, probably. So they just had, but they had clear crystals, this amazing thing. It's like a solid thing that you can look through. Like we could say glass, though. And then you put the color red behind it, and it looks like a ruby to some people, right? It looks like that thing now is actually red, and it's a red jewel. That's the idea, right? You put a color behind something clear, and it looks like all these, and it mentions all these gemstones, right? Because it's kind of a shiny. If you put the color gold behind it, it suddenly looks like a piece of gold, or a mahanila, right? All these different colored gemstones. So,
but that's really a mirror appearance.
It's a
of being a ruby.
So, it's a mirror appearance of being a ruby, and they talk about the clear crystal is like the other dependent character. So it's funny, all these analogies are slightly different. But you could also say the appearance of a ruby. I think that would be another part of the other dependent character. You could say also just the plain crystal before you add the color to it is also kind of like the other dependent character. You can almost say in that analogy there's two different kinds. Does that make sense? Let's keep looking at it a little bit. The actual ruby, there is no ruby there, right? It's an imagined ruby, but we really think there's a ruby. But the fact that there's actually no ruby in the crystal, that's the thoroughly established character in that one, right? It's the absence of the imputational in the other dependent. So this is interesting because you might think that, well, just seeing the crystal as the crystal, that would be the thoroughly established. We often understand it that way, I think. But really, that would just be realizing other dependent. But you're realizing the absence of the ruby in the crystal. So it might help to see that the crystal is just a crystal, but the definitive contemplation or meditation is to see that, like, that ruby that I really see when I look at it really clearly. In this case, you can imagine this, I really see it as a ruby, but I really know that it's not. I know that's just my imagination doing that, so you can apply it. I really think this is a floor, but once I come to contemplate this way, I know it's not. It still appears as a floor, and we say we're not trying to, you could say we'll realize that it's just a mere appearance of the floor, or it's just mind only. That's nice, that's good, but actually, more definitively enlightening is to realize that my idea of the floor doesn't reach the other dependent floor. Or like I brought up that Zen story of, you know, I'm always clearly aware, but words don't reach it. And see, you could say, well, isn't just the clear awareness good enough? But actually, the way I would interpret that story is what I'm really realizing is that any of my words can never reach this clear awareness. And the unreachability, that's the thoroughly established. It's they're very closely related in a certain way. You can see, well, isn't the clear awareness and the non-reachability of the words, they're kind of like, they're not one or not two. And the first four chapters of the sutra, if you have the book and you go back and read these beautiful early chapters, there are a lot about the ultimate truth and the conventional truth being not one or two, like a shell, a white shell and the whiteness of the shell. The white shell and the whiteness of the shell, well, they're not exactly the same, but you can't separate the whiteness of the shell from the white shell. So that's a little bit like this example. So this is a really nice, maybe clearer one about the mirage. So we see a mirage in the desert, and it really looks like, it really appears as water, but we know it's a mere appearance, but we really think that it's water even. And then you get, so the imputational is that it's water. We really believe it's water, but the actual, when you get up to it and the water disappears, then you see that actually there's no, the fact that there's no water in the mirage is the thoroughly established. I think that's a really nice, clear one. Because even if you know it's a mirage, right? You're looking at it and it's like, I know it's a mirage, but it really looks like water. Any kind of illusion, it's a mere appearance. It's an illusion, but it's sometimes very convincing. And I think realizing this doesn't mean that mere appearances stop. It still is going to look like the Zendo, but we just don't quite believe in the same way that it is, what it appears to be. So, and then this one is similar. It does, has a little twist here. The snake and the rope, talked about last time too. You know, it looks like a rope. It looks like a snake in the dark. But then when you get up close, it's actually just a rope on the ground. So it appears, there's a mere appearance of a rope. Oh no, that doesn't quite work there, does it?
But you think it's a snake?
Yeah, it actually appears to be a snake. It appears to be a snake, but actually, when you look, it's a rope. So it's these are all like a little different. You impute it to be a snake, and then when you realize that there's no, actually, you could say this column is like, you realize that there's no snake in the rope. The rope is completely lacks snakeness. But in this case, and this is a classical, it's either, I think it's a Sangha or Vasubandhu uses this one. They say, they take this even further and they say, when you look even closer, you see that it's not even a rope, it's just fibers that make up the rope. So that's like a twist, because you could say, really, isn't it about the absence of the snake and the rope? But in a way to say that fibers is, it's kind of like there's not even a rope. I think it's emphasizing the fact that there's not, that if you look at the mere appearance, it's not even accurate either. You know, later the sutra will say, this is kind of afflicted. This other dependent we think is so, like the energy soup is actually in itself afflicted because it actually just appears that way. And this is like non-appearance. The only, it talks about affliction and pure, so the actual purity is like nothing's actually appearing. So this gets kind of...
Further, wouldn't you even see that the fibers disappear?
Yeah, you could take that further. You could add... it's a metaphor.
Over to that next,
yeah, you can move the fibers and you could infinitely keep going beyond our, until there's just like, you know,
Buddha nature.
Yeah, which is, yeah, it's not even an appearance. It's so hard not to make this thoroughly established into some idea of something.
Discrimination has to stop before you get,
yeah, to really realize it. Yeah, it's the end of all discriminating thought and conceptual thought. Duality, and yet then to say, you know, in the earlier tradition, it's just emptiness is what you realize, and we're not going to say that anything good or bad about that, but just realize it and see what see how you live. And then but here they're actually, they start mixing it with this Buddha nature thing, and which is kind of dangerous because it's kind of, it's sounds kind of graspable. It's making something positive out of something negative. So this is a nice example, another metaphor here of the magician. So I guess in old India, there were street magicians who would take wood and mantras, as they used to make magic, and they, like a pile of sticks, they could create an appearance of an elephant. Maybe we can do these kind of things with drugs. But somehow it's a kind of hallucinogenic elephant. So there's this, the people, the nice thing about here is there's like three kinds of people who experience this thing. So there's the there's an appearance of an elephant. And then, but people, the audience, the magician, actually, yeah, the appearance is not the elephant. Yeah, they think it's really an elephant. So that imputational is that it's actually an elephant. This is the appearance, magical appearance of an elephant. And then, this is kind of funny, but the pieces of wood that they make it out of, it seems like, it's a little bit like the fibers thing. It's like, well, shouldn't we call it just an absence? But you could say, like the other one that this chapter in the sutra says, it's like faulty vision, and then it says the thoroughly established is the pure objective reference of clear vision, something like that. So it's like when you actually see wood, it's very plain. But the nice thing here is that they say it's like you have the magician, the audience, and then like bystanders who come back later after the mantra was cast, you know, the spell was cast. So the magician is like, they know that they just created this magical thing. So they actually see the elephant too. They see it totally real, but they know it's just a magical illusion because they're a magician. The audience actually So they say the magician's like a bodhisattva on this bodhisattva path, is that they see how they're constructing the world, but they don't believe it, but it still appears. The audience is like a regular deluded old sentient beings who actually just think that everything really is what it appears. And then the innocent bystanders who come by later, they actually just see wood.
They never see the elephant
because the mantra was that made it appear this way was cast. So they're like Buddhas. They say that at the final stage of Buddhahood, you don't even see the appearances anymore. And I used to constantly try to ask my teacher, well, this doesn't sound so great. Isn't it better for a bodhisattva? Wouldn't it be better to be a bodhisattva and live in the magical appearing world and be able to help people there than nothing appearing at all? Like, especially if you really, really don't believe it, but you can play in the appearing world and help the dream beings. Wouldn't that be better than like no appearance at all? Just like poof. And but the story, you know, the tradition's kind of like, well, if you, as a Buddha, when it really doesn't appear at all, then you can actually like create pure lands. You can like, and you can, it seems like a Buddha, like Shakyamuni Buddha, and well, I think it's talking about the Dharmakaya Buddha. There's no appearance, but you can manifest these transformation bodies in the appearing world of sentient beings. It was where it gets pretty far out. I don't think we need to go there, but just that's the story. That a Buddha, like, there's no karmic dispositions for the appearance anymore. That's maybe why it's so, because this, you just, the appearing world is due to this sentient being's karmic dispositions for appearances. So... That what? Yeah, we still have our own karma. So you can, and also you can see if you have any more questions about how these three work together, maybe we'll try to finish the chapter the next time, because we have another chapter about the three non-natures. Oh, we could. That could be a whole. Not. I think we can't do it today.
Please do that, since you've prepared it, since it's been something that's arisen here.
Mm.
Really,
maybe it could be a Dharma talk.
Well, or I was actually going to request something similar when we cover this last stanza,
because
to me that's really related.
Yeah.
You can think about if you could put that.
They are objects of compassion. Yeah. It says, right? Yeah. And I also have this like kind of this guided meditation on the three characters that I was hoping to do today, but as you can see, you know, it's kind of a complicated thing. It takes a while, but I think it's good to keep seeing how they work together and try applying it to like experiences, especially like kind of difficult experiences. That's when it might be really helpful. See, like, oh, that things really do appear this way. I'm not going to deny that. So there's no denial involved. And yet, I kind of know how I'm creating this, and I don't realize, but I have this sense that there's something beyond what appears here happening that's like totally free of like all my everything. Everything I think about it. May our intention equally extend to every being and place for the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. Surpassable. I